Hello and welcome to the World Soccer Talk podcast, your weekly dose of talking about watching soccer on TV, online and apps. Coming up on episode 36, we review the latest Gold Cup matches on Fox, as well as International Champions Cup, friendlies and more. Plus, we have a lot of questions and feedback from you, the listeners. My name is Christopher Harris, a.k.a. The Gaffer, and I'm joined by Kartik Krishnaiyer. Kartik, how are you?
I'm doing well, Chris. Thank you.
All right, so let's just jump right in, Kartik. For those listeners who have never had a chance to listen to the show before, instead of kind of focusing on every micro detail about tactics and formations and who's playing well and who's not playing well, we do a little bit of that, but most of it is focused on the television coverage and streaming coverage of the beautiful game. So the first question I'm going to ask you, Kartik, from this past week of what you've been watching, any highlights, anything that stood out that you were like just wowed by or really entertained by?
No, and actually I have to admit, and I'll admit it freely here, probably will tonight on the Tailgate Show also when I'm on, I haven't watched any of the Gold Cup other than the two games I went to. I mean, I haven't watched a minute of it. I haven't watched a single minute on television of the Gold Cup since I got back from the games I went to in Tampa. So, no, I haven't been entertained by it. I have really no interest in the tournament. The tournament allowing six guys to be called in for the knockout stages makes it an even bigger joke to me than it already is. God bless the clubs in Liga MX who didn't allow their players to be released for this because their season's starting in a week, and I congratulate them on that. So Mexico keeps going with the same squad of B teamers and C teamers. So I haven't had any interest in that. I have watched obviously, I was at the Orlando City B versus Tampa Bay game at Orlando City Stadium. I enjoyed that game. It was a contrast in styles. Tampa Bay, an older team, very British team. I'm probably the most British team outside of Britain at this point. Defending deep, playing with two lines of four for much of the game. Joe Cole, not the creative force that he could be or has been in the past, playing there for Stuart Campbell's team, who is, of course, British, also English coach in Tampa Bay, but very well organized. Veteran team got stuck in with veteran English players, a lot of veterans of the championship and League One, in addition to Cole, who obviously is a Premier League veteran. They got a 1-1 draw with Orlando City, who was coached by Tony Pulis' son, Anthony Pulis. Now, this might be interesting to our listeners. I don't think we've ever discussed this on this show. Anthony Pulis' style is not like his dad's. In fact, he was lamenting the fact that Stuart Campbell and Tampa Bay did not play football in this match in the post game, that they were defending deep and that they were it was a derby match and they basically came in to muck it up with an experienced squad. Now, the irony being, of course, what Pulis was lamenting is what we perceive as his father's style. Although I have to say, even by his father's standards, the Tampa Bay tactics, or if you want to call it that, strategy was incredibly cynical, even by a Tony Pulis standard. But you have to watch Anthony Pulis, and they passed the ball well. They play with the ball on the ground, lacked that creative spark in the final third, but equalized late behind Danny Deacon, the former Detroit City player, Sheffield native, another Englishman. And the Tampa Bay goal, I should mention, was scored by Martin Patterson, who bounced around the lower leagues in England for years. And came to Orlando City when they were in MLS. I had a much reported and talked about incident in New York City where he apparently went on a bender and got released and now is dropped down to USL to play for Tampa Bay. The thing that was interesting also about the match is I got a lot of insight into from talking to the other journalists there and talking to the people around the teams, the perception of USL productions and how they feel like the quality in camera, camera work and quality in broadcaster is improving as the season moves on. We've talked about this before. We've talked about it many times on the show, but that it's still not at the level that is satisfactory, particularly for fans of a club like Orlando, who are used to really high level stuff with their MLS club and with their NWSL club, and for Tampa Bay, which is a team that puts a lot of money, time, money, and effort into everything they do, and they do. They're a first-class club as far as lower divisions in American soccer is concerned. So it's getting there, the TV production. It's a work in progress, but it's not it's not satisfying a lot of the people who watch the league from a critical standpoint yet, but it's getting better.
I would say, though, Kartik, that I watched the Philadelphia Union against Swansea City friendly on YouTube, and I believe it was the Philadelphia TV channel, or I guess the in-house TV channel, and I was really surprised about how bad the commentating was. They had Marisa do kind of as co-com, and he was fine, kind of providing some analysis about some of the players he'd played with before and what type of players they were. But the actual commentator himself, I'm not sure, I didn't catch his name, but I was surprised by how poor that was. But that's the thing with USL, I think, for the most part. We're just looking for kind of a basic level of commentary that's consistent at this point. And it just seems to be kind of lots of highs and lots of lows. And hopefully in the coming months, it'll be more consistent.
Yeah, this week, Chris, has been an incredible week if you're an ESPN FC viewer, as I am. You've had Stuart Robson in studio, being Stuart Robson, being very kind of analytical and critical of things. You've had Ali Moreno, other than the day he went to call Salt Lake and Manchester United. Craig Burley has been in Los Angeles with Dan Thomas wearing some odd sunglasses, I must say, and it's become the butt of jokes on the show. But Burley was away for a few weeks, and he's been in rare form, really hammering some of these transfers and the flaws in some of these transfers. And then you've had, Sebastian Salazar in outstanding form. Just asking tough questions, whether it's about the Gold Cup, whether it's about transfers, whether it's about these friendlies, whether it's about general trends in soccer related to these things. Been in really good form. Hercules Gomez is continuing to impress. It's been a really good week on the show. And then, of course, they've had Steve Nichol chime in and say his bits, which are somewhat predictable, but are still usually on the mark from where I sit. And Casey Keller's been in studio this week, which is a treat. It's an odd thing with ESPN FC. I mean, every couple weeks, it seems, every third or fourth week, they bring Keller or Brian McBride in. They do quite well, but then they're not around after that. Now, I know Keller calls the Seattle games, so maybe he doesn't have the opportunity to come to Bristol that often. And as far as McBride's concerned, for whatever reason, he'll come for 3 or 4 days in a row and not be there after that. I think, again, it's probably geography. He's not living in Bristol or living in Hartford or living in the area. Mm-hmm. But they'll fly him in for a week. And same thing with Stuart Robson, for that matter. It's interesting, the analysis on the show, though. This is something that I've noticed now for a while, that there seems to be disagreements between the panel in the studio and Gabriel Marcotti quite often on news events and on transfers and on the value of transfers or the value of certain coaches. So that's or even on VAR. That's a continuing trend on the show. I don't know if some of the pundits in studio are just taking out a contrarian position from Marcotti, or if they generally don't like his point of view. I mean, remember, he comes at this from the point of view of a soccer reporter and a soccer journalist, and the others come from the point of view as a pundit or a commentator. So that's, or co-commentator. That's maybe the chief difference.
Yeah, it makes you wonder if they're going for the Fox kind of manufactured debate, where they before a match they say, okay, all right, you take this side, I'll take this side, and let's do a dry run, let's practice how this sounds. Okay, you sound upset and frustrated about this one thing, and then I'll come in and have an opposite opinion. So maybe with ESPN, I think in many ways, I think they all do it, not to the extent of Fox, but maybe ESPN is probably...
It seems much more natural and spontaneous on ESPN, I have to say, than it does on Fox. Okay. But, I mean, I'll readily admit I haven't watched a second of Fox's studio during the Gold Cup, so I don't know how that's going. I really don't have any interest. Again, don't want to talk too much about this, but I've made my views clear prior when it's CONCACAF or the U.S. is involved, how Fox covers events and covers teams and et cetera, and the sort of analysis they give. And the feedback I've gotten from people who've watched Fox during this tournament, unlike myself, is unfortunately reinforces those stereotypes I have of how they cover CONCACAF and how they cover the U.S. men's national team, very different than they covered Confederations Cup when they were forced out of their comfort zone and did, I thought, an outstanding job.
So Kartik, let's talk about CONCACAF just for a minute, and then I'll have you go back into the other games you watched. But I think it's one of those things with the Gold Cup. If any tournament needed VAR, the CONCACAF Gold Cup is it. Reason being is that the officiating is so bad. I mean, it's really poor at this level. So whether it's offside decisions, whether it's like last night, whether it was a biting incident or other things, this is a tournament that desperately needs VAR, and it doesn't have it. So it's not hurting the tournament, but it's definitely there's definitely some questionable calls and some questionable refereeing decisions there.
But that's part of I'm looking for the right adjective here, but yeah, this is part of the allure of CONCACAF. That was the word that was coming to mind, is that they're bad officiating decisions. There's always kind of gamesmanship, if you want to call it that, from players on national teams. There are always these controversies, the Maluda controversy about eligibility. By the way, Honduras got through to the knockout stages, and but Martinique did not because of that. These sorts of things are so CONCACAF. You can't have a CONCACAF tournament and operate it at the level a UEFA tournament operates at. You can't have a Euro type really kind of professional look and say CONCACAF. I mean, I think the CONCACAF Gold Cup now is more professionally run these last two editions with Soccer United Marketing, the marketing arm of MLS, operating it. The previous editions that were operated by the preceding editions right before that were operated by Traffic Sports were even more chaotic. It's just CONCACAF, right? And it's just part of the nature of the beast. And I think that's part of the color. Everybody complains about it, but that's part of the allure of CONCACAF. People pay attention to CONCACAF because this is a region where the last three presidents have all either been gone to jail or been banned from football, right?
Right. Yeah.
That's what it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a region where they deliberately set up a tournament so that the U.S. and Mexico meet in the final. And when one of them is not going to, if it's possible that neither makes the final, there's some degree of hanky-panky, as we saw when Mexico played Panama last year, the day after the United States had been eliminated by Jamaica. It's a bit of a sham. You just have to accept that. You can't go in with the expectation watching the Gold Cup that it's a legitimate tournament like the Euros or like Copa America.
A lot of the media treat it as it is, though. I mean, this tournament is probably the best example. I wouldn't say a joke. I mean, that's going a little bit too far. But in terms of a not very well run, not very serious competition.
No serious competition is going to allow you to change your half your starters essentially after the group stage of a tournament. Just put that in context.
Right, exactly. And it's one of those things that I mean, the level of football has been for the most part pretty poor across the board. I mean, and also even just the level of competition in terms of the teams that they're bringing in and the players.
That's a region. I mean, which of these countries would qualify from CONMEBOL for the World Cup? I don't know. I don't think any of them.
None of them.
Which of these countries would qualify from UEFA? Now I hear people who say that Europe's qualifying is easy, and oh, maybe you'll get into a group with Albania or Northern Ireland. But I don't know that a CONCACAF country would qualify from a group with Northern Ireland and Albania, and they certainly. Someone told me, oh, well, there's a group where Switzerland's leading. Well, I don't think a CONCACAF country would beat Switzerland, honestly, competitively. So it's a bad region right now. And it wasn't always this bad, right? Let's keep in mind Costa Rica, they're at the tail end of this generation. They got to the quarterfinals of the last World Cup. They almost got to the semifinals. The United States, obviously, and Costa Rica were both very good in 2002. And there have been spots where the U.S. have had good teams. This is a chance to kind of tease something I'm working on, but the U.S. were, I think, a couple of injuries away and a car accident away in going into the 2010 World Cup from having a really good team, a team that could possibly have gotten to that World Cup semifinals. But I think right now you're in a dip in the region. Mexico has more guys than ever playing in Europe, and so we're kind of fooled by that, but they're not significantly better than they've been.
I would say, Kartik, I would say
the United States is a lot worse than they bear.
Well, to me, I was thinking about that this morning. I was thinking that I can't remember such a bad U.S. team. I mean, this is not a full strength team, but I mean, the new players came in last night to kind of strengthen the team. But even last night in the performance against El Salvador, they were poor. I mean, like really displaced passes.
We do this to analyze broadcasting, but maybe this is, and we don't really want to analyze tactics or the matches, but I'll throw this out there because you don't necessarily hear it on Fox or from people who always want to pretend like the U.S. national team is getting better and better and better, except when Jurgen Klinsmann's the manager, because look, I don't think Klinsmann was a good manager. Those people who follow me on social media know that, but it seems like he was largely railroaded by elements of the media in this country. Mm-hmm. I've come to that conclusion, even though I was one of those who was very critical of him when he was a manager. Except when Jurgen Klinsmann was a manager, there doesn't seem to be the proper critique on this national team. Where is the Claudio Reyna in this team? 10 years on, the U.S. hasn't developed another player like him. Where is the John O'Brien in this team? 10 years on, the U.S. hasn't developed another player like him. Where is the Eddie Pope or Gucci Onuyewu pre-injury, that speaking of 2009 and 2010, in this team? The U.S. 8 years on from Gucci's injury, basically 10, 12, 15 years on from Pope's heyday, hasn't developed a player. Where's the Steve Cherundolo in this team? All those years on, the U.S. hasn't developed another player of that caliber playing at the fullback position. You could go on and on. The U.S., you keep hearing about how much money is being spent in soccer, how much better everything's getting, all these MLS academies, blah, 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 so many more people playing the sport, so many more people watching the sport. That is all true. But the actual end product, as far as the national team is concerned, is significantly worse than it was 10 or 15 years ago, in my opinion.
No,
I just ran through players that the U.S. have. The U.S. doesn't have anyone comparable to those guys that I just named.
I agree. And this is against teams that are subpar in terms of across the world scale, in terms of teams like Martinique, teams like Nicaragua, teams like El Salvador. These are teams in the past that the U.S. would have just run right over. And in each of those three games, they were competitive. There were chances for each of those opposing teams to win these games if they could have put their chances away, which they didn't. And the U.S. was lucky for that. I would say, though, Kartik, that, and you missed this, but thank God for Fernando Fiore, because in the El Salvador game at halftime, Alexi Lalas was kind of like talking about the U.S. and Ali Wagner was too, as well as Rob Stone. And Fernando Fiore was coming in, and I said, "Hey, wait, guys, look at this. Look at the bad passing by Dempsey, especially. Look at the U.S. is not playing that well." Because before the match,
here's another problem I have. Okay, with Fox, and this is a CONCACAF event, and those of us who actually watch football beyond the U.S. men's national team in this country, we interact with a lot of players from the CONCACAF region. So when you look at the El Salvador team, I personally, as someone who's covered the sport and worked in the sport in this country, have stronger and better relationships with the guys on that team. Richie Menjivar played for the Tampa Bay Rowdies for a number of years. He's a player who was discovered by Eric Winalda, who I guess wasn't on the broadcast when he was playing in Southern California, and Waldo took him to the Atlanta Silverbacks. Gerson Mayan, and Gerson Mayan is a player who started for El Salvador last night, who I worked with for two seasons with the Fort Lauderdale Strikers. You have Darwin Saren, who I covered for a number of years, playing for Orlando City. Why doesn't Fox talk about the guys who played in MLS or played in the U.S. leagues and developed in the U.S. leagues as much as they should? And there are people like me who have sentiment for those guys and want to see those guys do well. The fact that they're playing the United States doesn't really impact me. 2 years ago, I openly admit James Marceline from the Strikers had a great game against the U.S. for Haiti, and I was rooting for Haiti in that game.
Yeah, Lalas was pretty condescending in this match, especially pre-match, in terms of he was saying that, you mean, the U.S. should win this one 3-0, 4-0. And Fernando Fiore was saying, like, wait, guys, this is a competitive match. El Salvador has got how to play against a team like this.
Question. Let me ask you that very basic question, okay, getting back to another point I made earlier. When they would say that during the Jurgen Klinsmann era, guys like Lalas, oh, they should win this match 3-0, 4-0, this is and then Lalas would come back at halftime saying, this is garbage, and criticize the tactics, and then after the game criticize Klinsmann. Where is that for Bruce Arena?
There isn't. So post-match, Lalas is actually, I mean, Lalas, when it comes to the U.S., is always raising the bar. So post-match, I think Maybe it was halftime. I think it was halftime. He was saying, okay, yes, the U.S. is leading 2-0 at half, but they should be playing better. They should be trying harder. They should be doing more. But that's not the manager that he's looking at. He's looking at across the entire playing squad and saying, okay, we need to raise the bar.
Credit here to Sebastian Salazar on ESPN FC earlier in the week. Last week, he raised that issue with the panel, saying, hey, there seems to be a difference in how Bruce Arena's covered. Now, he didn't attribute it to some of the things I might attribute it to, why Klinsmann was criticized more than Arena. But he said there are obviously people who cover the sport in this country who've been burned by Bruce before or have dealt with him and have just decided to back off in this instance. This was, I think this was after the Martinique game. They had this conversation on ESPN FC, but there are not enough people raising that. I mean, I look at a guy like Salazar, who knows the U.S. game. He would have been perfect for Fox to hire and put in the studio when the U.S. is playing or there's a CONCACAF event. Knows Mexico, obviously, very well, too. Knows Europe as well, but they obviously didn't hire him. And it goes back to, I think, the mentality of Fox, the kind of personality they're looking for, and Rob Stone fits it.
Yeah, and that's the concern that we had and do still have about Fox when it comes to U.S. games, is that they're too positive, too rah-rah. And like I said, too, thank God for Fernando Fiore. At least he was able to step in and say, like, hey, wait a second, guys. These are good players. This is a good team. They know how to play against the United States. This is going to be not as easy of a match as you think it is. It might end up being 2-0, but it's not going to be 3-0, 4-0, 5-0, like you said, Lalas.
Although in reality, every game with the U.S. calling in the cavalry, so to speak, and Mexico not doing that, and other countries that are engaged in World Cup qualifying kind of being conservative as to their selections, the U.S. should, and the U.S. being at home, they should rip right through this tournament, but they haven't been.
Well, they should if they're playing to the level that we expect them to play at, and they're far, far off that. The other thing, one more thing too, Kartik, before I go back to you to talk about some of the other matches you watched, is just even the opening line for John Strong in the U.S. El Salvador game was, again, condescending. And he said, okay, the big boys are here, and now the tournament can really begin. And to me, that kind of dismisses the entire tournament up to this point. And now says, okay, all right, now you got Michael Bradley, Josie, and Clint Dempsey. And now all of a sudden, now this is the real U.S. team. Well, we saw the real U.S. team, and yes, they did win that match. But again, that was, to me, another poor performance. And that's, three in a row from the U.S.?
Right. Again, you're looking at a situation where the United States is taking this tournament much more seriously than Mexico is.
Yep.
This was the case in 2013 also. The U.S. last time they won this tournament, and everybody was rah-rah about that. Mexico was in a bad spot with their A team at the time, but they sent the B team. In fact, the guy who had the most caps going into that Gold Cup in 2013 was Rafael Marquez Lugo, who had 11 caps coming into that tournament. They sent an absolute B team. Chepo was still managing them, and it was rah-rah USA. We won the tournament, having called in guys like Landon Donovan and DeMarcus Beasley, although I will mention that Klinsmann gave Dempsey and Altidore and a number of other guys that tournament off. Bruce Arena has not done that now. So they have to win the tournament. I think you're right that John Strong's line was somewhat condescending, but also I have to say, what's the value of a tournament that allows you to swap out six guys and after the group stage?
Yep.
It makes you think, this the tournament has no value. It's starting now, even though we're 2 weeks into the tournament. Look, I mean, I was more interested in what was going on in MLS after the break yesterday, full slate of games, but then I was in the Gold Cup, and that's just the way it is. But so moving on, one guy who never pulls his punches is Taylor Twellman, and he was in tow with Adrian Heath for the Galaxy Manchester United match at the StubHub Center on
Saturday.
Thank you. Saturday night, and really, really good discussion. I think about Jermaine Jones from Taylor Twellman and Adrian Healy. Really good discussion about Pogba, how Pogba can play. Twellman was contrasting the Pogba we've seen with France, even in this most recent friendly with England, how he dominates matches from kind of a number eight position to the Pogba, the kind of passive Pogba we've seen at times with Manchester United. Healy got in about the physicality of the Premier League, and maybe that was something Pogba was not had to get used to. I think also there was personally an issue. My analysis is there was an issue of midfield partner for Pogba. Believe it or not, I know there are a lot of Manchester United fans who don't like certain players, but I believe it or not, I think Pogba played better last season when he was paired with Marouane Fellaini in central midfield than when he was paired with Michael Carrick, who to me is one of the best players in his generation, English players, or with any of the other midfield combos, Ander Herrera, who I think is too valuable. You have to play him somewhere. But right. Fellaini's tactical discipline allowed Pogba to do a lot of roaming. So there was a discussion of this on air. There was a discussion of Jermaine Jones, as I mentioned, what's his future in the national team, what his past was. And it made what was a friendly game, and Twelman can do this, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I have to give Healy some credit, too, because obviously he was facilitating the discussion. But Taylor Twelman has this ability to make a game that, to me, had absolutely no... I had no interest in this match. Interesting, because I'm listening to the analysis just to hear what Twelman says and what he talks about important topics related to players on those two teams, which are things I'm interested in, even if I'm not interested in the match. So one of a kind in, as far as American co-commentators go. Two nights later, you had Real Salt Lake and Manchester United. Similar discussion from Moreno and Healy, although Moreno, I watch every day on ESPN FC, and I like him a great deal, but I'm overexposed to him, right? So I kind of know what his opinions are. But he gave some very, very good points, again, about Jose Mourinho and the signings. And Moreno's big thing, and this, whether it's on ESPN FC or in the broadcast of this game, is you spend the kind of money Manchester United have the last two summers, you don't have any excuses. And Moreno seemed quite annoyed that Mourinho continued to talk about winning the strain of the Europa League, the strain of winning the League Cup, and how that affected their Premier League form. Moreno, during the broadcast, said, "You finished sixth in the Premier League. It's bottom line, right? Yeah. You finished sixth in the league." So,
but that's the thing, Kartik. That, I mean, to me, Adrian Healy and Alejandro Moreno need to have their own talk show. They need to have their own podcast, because I was watching this game, and actually this game was really competitive. I really enjoyed this one. But,
yeah, yeah. But, it was better than the other games.
Oh, yeah. But Moreno and Healy were just carrying on conversations throughout the whole match as the game was going on, as things were happening, as like a really bad foul was happened on the pitch and the referee didn't call it. They just talked right over it. They were talking about predicting that Real Salt Lake, I think they were joking, but Real Salt Lake would win the MLS Cup and Manchester United would win the Champions League. And those conversations, kind of like you said, too, in terms of some of the players on the pitch and like how well they're doing and this, that, and the other. But to me, you're missing the match. And this is a really competitive match.
Well, right. And Moreno wasn't talking about how the players were doing in that particular game. He was talking about just overall kind of macro themes,
right,
which I enjoy hearing. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I guess as far as calling the game, I would encourage ESPN to do that. I mean, it seems they have so many personalities now, guys who've developed personalities that you didn't necessarily have you didn't know had personalities before, like Kirk Gomez, who does the podcast with Max Bredos, like Alejandro Moreno, who now has been in studio with Craig Burley for 4 years. So if you didn't have personality before, that will bring it out of you, working with Burley, and Stevie Nichol, who I could listen to over and over again about things, and who's really up on what's going on in Spain and Italy as well, not just in England and Scotland. I don't think he's as up on Germany, but he's up on most of the European leagues. So you could have that. There's just a lot of personality in ESPN soccer team, personality in a positive way, where they're talking about soccer, just kind of different than Fox. So I definitely got that from this game. And then, as I said, all week long, ESPN FC has been very good. And with Stuart Robson over here on American soil for the week, there has... as you would expect, a lot of conversation about what Arsenal is not doing. And that's just a whole nother conversation. But just wrapping up on what I've watched this week, it seems like even with these friendlies going on, even with the Gold Cup going on, major theme, if you watch ESPN FC, is transfers. And the friendlies are only big in how they relate to the transfers. Well, is Manchester United going to sign another central midfielder? How is Lukaku fitting in these first two games? Do they seem to miss some leadership with Rooney having gone back home to Everton, to his boyhood club? That seems to be the theme that either Thomas, when he's hosting, or Salazar. It's been more Salazar, actually, lately. What they play on is transfers. It's all about transfers. It's all about the market from the standpoint of the guys who are in that studio being ridiculous at this point. The amount of money being spent on guys who are, from the perspective of analysts like Stevie Nicol and Ali Moreno and guys like that, just above average players. Mm-hmm. Silly money being spent on them.
And to me, it's all about ratings. It's all about having topics that, you know, that people, for the most part, most soccer fans will be like, hey, tell me about Alvaro Morata. And is he going to go to Chelsea? And, Lukaku, how's that going to shake up things at Man United? And it's, to me, it's all about ratings. And through the websites, it's all about clicks.
Surprisingly, strangely, yeah. Website clicks, TV, ESPN. NFC television ratings, there have been dissatisfaction with most of the transfers. Yeah, ESPN FC led off with Neymar two straight days, which is not something that many in the media are giving that much credence. But the thing that I found really interesting, and maybe our listeners found this odd too if they were watching ESPN FC, there has been nothing but criticism of Lukaku's transfer to Manchester United. This isn't the right guy. They paid too much. He's not going to fit in with Jose Mourinho. The Morata signing, interestingly, from Nicol, from Robson, from Moreno, from Burley, talking about the first prospect of them getting Morata. He hasn't been weighed in since they signed him, and company has been a positive one. So I was thinking, well, maybe they're just slamming every transfer because Kyle Walker, Stevie Nicol, saying he's not really even an average defender. He's fast going forward, but doesn't fit Pep's style. They overpaid for him. Danilo, same thing, overpaid, et cetera, et cetera. But this transfer, for whatever reason, they've embraced. I don't know if that's it. So that's why I'm thinking the way you were earlier in the week. Well, maybe they're generating controversy by just ripping a lot of these transfers and the fees. But it sounds like their entire studio commentary team likes the Morata transfer. And in fact, Robson speculates that was actually the guy they wanted all along, that the transfer committee and Emenelu and these guys back room at Chelsea were forcing other ideas for whatever reason, but that from a pure playing standpoint, Morata's the guy Conte would have wanted all along, and now he's got him.
Yeah, and it's also the middle of the summer too, so they're looking for topics that they could. I mean, they don't have the rights to the Gold Cup. I mean, they have the rights to the Women's Euro 2017, and they don't have. Actually, they have rights to some of the friendlies, but there's not a lot of kind of coverage to talk about. So I think timing-wise, and also just in terms of just attraction, just topics that they know will pull crowds into. I think it works really well for them. Anything else, Kartik, before I move on to my list?
No, that's it for me. I mean, I tried to keep an eye on MLS as I came back Wednesday night, and obviously that is also a little bit interesting because they had a full slate of games. I think they had eight or nine games on a night when the U.S. was playing in this Gold Cup tournament. So that certainly probably divided the audience somewhat.
Yeah, and like you said too, Liga MX starts this weekend. Actually, Friday night it already starts up again. So the past week, Kartik, for me, it's been a mixture of watching Gold Cup and friendlies. So Gold Cup. Not too much to mention. The only thing I would have mentioned that I haven't mentioned already is that I did listen to one of the games on Sirius XM FC on satellite radio. I was driving someplace and I was listening to Panama against Martinique. And it was interesting because I was able to hear that just the audio of the match. And it's a Fox, I think it was FS1 or FS2, probably FS2, that broadcast on the radio as I'm driving. And Mark Folwell and Tony Mueller were pretty good. And then the halftime show. And to me, it was just Fernando Fiore. He sounds worse on radio than he does on television, because on television, he's very animated. He's doing different gestures and all this and that. But on radio, all you hear is his voice. And it's kind of he's all over the place, and it, for radio it didn't work as well, but still it was kind of, I thought it was a little bit funny. And then the US games we talked about. So for me, other than the Gold Cup, I've watched so many friendlies this week, Kartik. I watched Malaga against Sheffield United. I watched St. Gallen against Southampton, Monaco against Stoke City, Philadelphia Union against Swansea City, Manchester United against LA Galaxy, and also, let me see, Real Salt Lake against Manchester United, AC Milan against Dortmund, Liverpool against Crystal Palace, FC 20 against Everton, and I think that was it on the friendly side. For me, watching friendlies is interesting because I get to see, for a couple of different reasons. One is kind of scouting, seeing some of these new players coming through the systems and seeing if there's any players that are impressing me, or even some players that I do know, and seeing if maybe if they're not fit. Like, for example, one example, and this is a player who's coming back from injury, was Charlie Austin for Southampton, and he looks really far off fitness, high fitness levels, understandably so, but it's still got a long way to go before he becomes, I think, back to what he was before. The other reason I like watching friendlies too is Fantasy Premier League. So FPL is starting up in a couple of weeks, and so I'm kind of like scouting players too to see, okay, are there any players that are standing out that I'm thinking like, oh, I forgot about him, maybe I can put him into my squad. And I also enjoy the other thing too. I enjoy watching games from stadiums that are so small and you've got standing room only. It's just a really quaint stadiums in different places. Like the St. Gallen game against Southampton was in the valley, and it was just a beautiful mountain ranges. I don't know if it was the Alps nearby. It was just lots of things that you wouldn't normally see in a typical game. So lots of friendlies I watched, and there was one other thing I was going to mention. Oh, yeah, I watched Germany against Sweden in the Euro 2017 Women's Championship. This one ended up being a 0-0 match, and it was the first time that Sweden has ever avoided defeat against Germany in a competitive women's tournament. It was a really good match, but it was one of those very tense, very... for some, it would be boring, but it was basically very tense. When it was just more a game of chess than it was a game of football, and but still, I enjoyed it. Very good defending.
Did you say that Germany had never lost competitively to Sweden before, or had never not beaten Sweden competitively before?
Sweden has never beaten. Well, actually, it says so. In my notes, I got Sweden as. First time Sweden has ever avoided defeat against Germany. So in a competitive women's tournament.
That's surprising, because from my perspective, Sweden had a better team than Germany in the late 90s, in the early 2000s. I mean, then Germany really kind of put their foot on the women's game, and it has been the top side since. Not surprising with Sweden that they were playing tactically very kind of defensively and very organized. That's been Pia Sundhage's calling card, really. That's the way they play. So
and it might have been one of those things. It might just be a bogey team, where it's one of those teams that like Sweden just can never seem to get anything when they do play Germany. But it was a good game, good level of play there. And last but not least, Kartik, I watched the George Best documentary, which is called All By Himself, which I know you watched and you wrote a review on, and that's on the worldsoccertalk.com website. I watched it. It's coming out on Thursday, and it's coming out at 8:30 Eastern time on ESPN. So for those listening to the podcast, if you catch it, great. If you miss it, I'm sure they'll be putting it on to watchESPN.com, where you can watch the whole thing there. I have to say, though, Kartik, I did enjoy it, but I was surprised by how much of the focus was on alcoholism, because it seemed to be like the last, probably like the last 25% to 30% of the show was just focused intensely on that. And it ended up being more about the disease that he was going through and really grappling with, and that eventually killed him. And I was surprised by that. It was really... for me, depressing to watch, but still worth watching, because I learned a lot more about him as an individual, but all everything he had to go through. But I was just surprised at how little soccer there was, except for in the beginning, of course.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think the the thing that made it so dramatic for me was the stuff that happened in the United States has been well documented. He played here with Fort Lauderdale. I know some of those stories. I know some stories that weren't in the documentary about what happened in town when he was here. Obviously San Jose, you heard the story of him being sober for months and then winning the goal of the year for that unbelievable goal, which is actually against Fort Lauderdale, and then going on, I think it was a 22-day bender. So these are the sorts of rich anecdotes you have in the documentary when you watch it. One thing I would point out is, to me, the thing that made it so so interesting was hearing the words of Sir Matt Busby and getting that audio and putting that, superimposing that in the documentary as things are about to turn. Now, I guess in any kind of narrative like this, you have the rise and you have the fall, right? And the period where the rise becomes the fall, largely narrated by Sir Matt Busby himself in some audio from the time, contemporary audio or audio from the late 60s and early 70s, as he was facing out his role at Manchester United himself. I found that in the most kind of compelling part of this documentary is the audio from Sir Matt, the audio from the likes of Ray Hudson, the audio from all of his family and all of his friends and journalists who had covered him at the time, that served as the voice, as the narrator of this documentary. There wasn't an assigned narrator. The one interview I wish Daniel Gordon had gotten and he didn't get was Rodney Marsh, and I'm not sure why that was.
I was surprised too.
Rodney Marsh played with him in London, helped lure him over when he had signed with Tampa Bay, helped lure him over to the United States to play in in the NASL, and I continued to have a relationship with him. In fact, I think we have appeared with him on television as pundit at times. Towards the end of Best Life. That was one guy that was missing for me in the documentary. But other than that, I highly recommend it.
I think that the challenge for this one, Kartik, is that there was so much to tell in such a short amount of time that this could have easily been a 3-hour documentary. Because what happens is that you kind of see the path and the history and everything he goes through. And then all of a sudden, he goes from San Jose, according to the film, he goes to San Jose, and then he jumps back to Fulham. And then it seems like it's like kind of like just a few years later, then he's dead in the hospital. And of course, there's so much that happens. There's all the clubs he goes to, he plays for. There's this work with Sky as a pundit. I mean, there's so many stories there that were cut out. And I'm wondering whether that was kind of from a time constraints point of view, because this documentary will premiere in the US on television. Like I said, on Thursday night, right before the Manchester United-Manchester City derby, the International Champions Cup game. But this could have easily been a 3-hour film. And I'm wondering whether when the DVD does come out, if there's a whole bunch of outtakes, or maybe there were some interviews with Rodney Marsh, but they just couldn't fit it in terms of the narrative.
That seems to happen with 30 for 30s. This is something that if you get the 30 for 30s on DVDs or you watch the digital versions later, there are outtakes with the director. There are scenes that are cut. There are whole themes that are scrapped because of time limitations, because you are still putting it on ESPN, cutting it to fit in an hour and a half or 2-hour window with commercials. So keep that in mind. So I think you're probably right. That happens. I've seen a couple of the documentaries they've done, like the Boston College college basketball documentary from the late 70s, that there were some things that were cut from that, that when they're put back in the film, make it even more compelling. I think that might be the case with the Notre Dame University of Miami documentary, which I enjoyed. Thought it was told a little too much from a Notre Dame perspective as a Miami guy, but they do that with 30 for 30s. Remember, these aren't like HBO documentaries or Showtime documentaries, which by the way are great, I think that there's more flexibility as far as time with those. You still have to fit into some sort of window, but you don't have commercials. So this documentary, I believe, only runs about an hour and 15 minutes in reality, because of even though it's in an hour and a half window. So that's a lot to crowd into relatively short space. But I still highly recommend it.
So coming up in a little bit, we're going to talk about International Champions Cup and who will be the play-by-play commentators for both the English language and Spanish language broadcasts. But first, a word from our sponsor. 11 Miami, South Florida's premier nightlife destination and only 24/7 Ultra Club, is giving away a pair of VIP tickets to El Clasico Real Madrid versus FC Barcelona's game on Saturday, July 29th at Hard Rock Stadium in Miami. All you have to do is go to 11miami.com/classico to win premium VIP seats that include food and beverage during the game. But you have to enter now as the contest ends on July 24th. You can also win two tickets for the PSG against Juventus game on July 26th and VIP bottle service at 11 Miami's rooftop viewing party on July 29th to watch Real Madrid against Barcelona on their 16-foot LED screen. Once again, the giveaway will end Monday, July 24th, so register now. Go to 11miami.com/classico. and register for the chance to see Real Madrid versus FC Barcelona live in person at Hard Rock Stadium in Miami, July 29th, courtesy of 11 Miami's nightclub. Okay, Kartik, so let's move on to TV streaming news.
Yeah, a lot happening in the world of TV, and we just teased it. ESPN, ESPN Deportes, ESPNU, and ESPN News will combine to present the International Champions Club Cup, which has already started from July 18th to July 30th. Play voices are John Champion in English and Fernando Palomo in Spanish. They will be the leading commentators. There will, of course, be other commentators involved. They will call these international preseason matches between championship winning clubs and clubs that also have perception, you know, big names. Manchester City didn't win anything last year, but they're in this between all these clubs for this 2-week tournament, if you will. And you've noticed ESPN is not just covering the US-based games, but also China, Australia, wherever they're being played abroad.
That's right. And also Derek Ray is going to be doing some of the commentaries, too. It's good to see John Champion as the lead commentator. But Derek Ray, I believe he's doing about six games, so including the Manchester Derby. So it'll be interesting to listen and hear his voice again. It's been a while since we've had a chance to listen to it for so many times in such a short period of time. So on to other news, and that's two websites have been redesigned over the summer. The first is the beIN Sports Connect website, which has now moved to a new address, which is connect.beinsports.com. And the second is the NBC Sports Soccer section, which is now at soccer.nbcsports.com and is a much improved design compared to previously. Now, the nbcsports.com/live section actually redirects to this new section on the NBC Sports website. And it's been redesigned. It's a much wider format, so to make it easier to read some of the stories. And in both cases, both the beIN Sports Connect and the NBC Sports Soccer site, they look great. They look good. It's a breath of fresh air from what they looked like before. I think most of us listeners have seen it so many times that we know what it looks like. But now, if you go there, I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. So, Kartik, I want to give a shout-out to our sponsor, and that's SeatGeek. SeatGeek, buying tickets to sports and concerts can be complicated, but there is a better, simpler way to buy, and that's with SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the smartest, easiest way to get tickets to live events. With SeatGeek's seamless mobile experience, you can buy and sell tickets in just two taps. SeatGeek helps you find the best seats at the best prices, fully guaranteed. There's nothing quite like seeing your favorite team in person, and SeatGeek will get you closer to the action for a great value. I have the SeatGeek app on my phone, and it's by far the easiest way I've found to shop for tickets. I missed the Swansea game against Philadelphia Union and the game on Wednesday evening against Richmond Kickers. And I'm probably going to miss the one this weekend against North Carolina. Reason being, I've just been so busy with work, and I'm actually working on a book. So that's the reason why I haven't been able to get away to these matches. But if I was going to go, I'd be using the SeatGeek app. It's designed to make your ticket buying experience easier than ever. It saves you time and money by searching multiple ticket sites to compare prices and find amazing deals. And to get you the most bang for your buck, SeatGeek grades every ticket based on value to help you immediately identify the best seats that fit your budget. Plus, every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. Make SeatGeek your go-to app for finding the best deals on every type of ticket, from sports and concerts to comedy and theater. Best of all, my listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code WSTPOD today. That's promo code WSTPOD for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Now, Kartik, moving on to TV ratings. We don't have every single one here. All of them are listed at worldsoccertalk.com for all the different games. Any highlights here from some of the numbers that we have in front of us?
Yeah, I mean, Mexico games, irrespective of the kind of team Mexico fields, always get great numbers on Univision and Unimas. That's, I think, to me, very, very telling. Now, the thing that I think has been a little surprising to me in this tournament is that Univision has gotten better numbers for U.S. games than the Fox networks have, other than that very first U.S. game that was on against Panama, that was on Fox over the air. So that is a trend I want to continue to track, because I've had that suspicion that that would happen. Now, we haven't had the head-to-head comparison with Telemundo, who will be covering the World Cup next year, but will there be some bleed? Now, and during the World Cup, you have all kinds of casuals that come, and they're going to watch Fox, right? Mm-hmm. But will the core soccer audience that is engaged in the sport now, a year out from a World Cup, will they all gravitate to Fox as the English language rights holder? Or will there be bleed to the network covering the tournament in Spanish? In this case, this tournament, Univision, but next summer, Telemundo. Based on the Martinique match and the Nicaragua match, we're seeing that. So that's something to watch, and that's something that Fox may claim they're not concerned about. Maybe they're not, because they're going for a more casual audience and a raw kind of jingoistic audience, maybe people who are less sophisticated in how they take in the sport. But that's something I would continue to track. So those are the ones that really stand out for me.
Yeah, for me, it's been I'm actually looking closely at the numbers for the Mexico matches on FS1 to see how those numbers are doing, because Fox has positioned Mexico as America's second team. Which I know to me at least it's I don't know, that's a long story, but to me it's not a true representation of how the average soccer fan, American soccer fan, feels. They don't feel like Mexico's the second team. That's like saying, like, for English fans, Scotland's your second team. Well, that's not the case. But the numbers in terms of FS1 for the Mexico games, 280,000 for the Mexico against Jamaica match. 302,000 for Mexico against Curaçao. FS1 is putting a lot of effort into promoting Mexico. And even in the U.S. games, in the halftime, there's usually a segment on Mexico. And that's something we haven't seen in the past before. So with Fox picking up a lot of the English language rights to the FMF Mexico.
Those are better numbers than we had during the Confederations Cup, though, for a lot of Mexico games, group stage games. So some upward progress, and the Univision numbers are also higher than the Telemundo numbers, which, again, it may be timing of games, prime time versus the middle of the day. It also may be the relevance of the tournament. Look, I think the Gold Cup is not a very serious tournament, but I don't think the Federations Cup is a very serious tournament also. I think I said that when we had that when we were covering that tournament. So Mexican fans are probably still more interested in a tournament that is going on American soil where they live, and potentially could crown them as continental champions, even with a B team.
But also, I think, Kartik, too, you've got, you got Costa Rica, you've got Panama, you've got El Salvador, Nicaragua. You've got a lot of listeners, Spanish-speaking listeners, that will watch Univision.
Some of those countries.
Games.
Yeah, some of those countries. There aren't that many Costa Ricans in the U.S., but Salvadorians, well, there are. Hondurans, there are.
Right, but rather than, say, Confederations Cup, in terms of...
There probably has many Americans in Costa Rica, actually, but... Yeah. Go ahead.
So far, I think from the numbers I've seen so far, that Univision is about 20% further ahead than Telemundo was for the Confederations Cup. So the Gold Cup, there's more people watching the Gold Cup than there were at the Confederations Cup. But like I said, too, I think a lot of that, too, is just there's a lot of more Spanish-speaking countries playing in this tournament for the Gold Cup than there would be for, say, Confederation Cup, where, I mean, it's Mexico and Chile.
Right, and obviously there are people who watch Jamaica and Caribbean nations as well that are in this country.
Exactly, exactly. And one more thing I do want to highlight about the TV numbers is that NWSL got its best number so far this season on Lifetime. And I had 127,000 watch the North Carolina Courage against Portland Thorns game. So week by week, those numbers are going up and up and up. Last week, or the week before that, was the best number, and now they've gotten the best number, beat that one. So things are looking up for Lifetime.
And that might be a reflection also of less soccer being on to compete with. And then that particular game, Portland versus North Carolina, was a big, big game in terms of the NWSL table. So I think that had something to do with it as well.
Okay, so let's move on to listener mailbag. And the first one is from Mike from Salt Lake City, and he sent this in through email. He says, I'm a newer listener to your podcast, about 4 months or so. I enjoy the podcast, but I don't understand your criticism of Fox being pro-American with their soccer coverage. The majority of the audience resides in the United States and is mostly interested in the U.S. men's national team. So why not devote more coverage to the team that your audience is interested in? I think Fox can be objective, and a U.S. Men's National Team cheerleader in their analysis. ESPN FC shows you how you can balance support for the U.S. team and be critical when warranted. I feel you only criticize Fox because they are cheerleaders, and I think Fox is appealing to the soccer fans who will make up most of the viewing audience, fans of the U.S. Men's National Team. I enjoy the podcast. Kartik, what do you think about this one?
Yeah, I think he's right to a large extent, which is that Fox is appealing to casual fans who aren't hardcore soccer fans. That will be the majority of the viewing audience in 2018. And I just mentioned that would be the core. That's what they're striving for. ESPN FC, look, ESPN FC talks about, it's not talking about the U.S. constantly. It's the way they talk about the U.S. It's the way any guy who has played decently well in MLS has elevated themselves to just kind of the status. And, look, I was very critical of Jurgen Klinsmann. You can go back and look at my Twitter feed from when Klinsmann was the manager the last 2 years in particular, from maybe early 2015, late 2014 until he was sacked, and see that I was no fan of his tactics, not necessarily a fan of his squad selection, had called him at times a charlatan because of the things he would say in the press to deflect criticism of him. But to me, there is a very clear difference in how Fox covers a Bruce Arena-led team versus a Jurgen Klinsmann-led team. And I saw that in the pregame shows and the postgame shows and the halftime of the qualifiers that they've shown since Arena became the manager, the three qualifiers that have been on Fox. And that's all I needed to see was basically there is a certain degree of cheerleading. And I don't know if it's necessarily U.S.-oriented, Chris, now that I'm thinking about it and talking it through, or if it's MLS-oriented. And if it has to do with guys who played in Major League Soccer or have some connection to the league, Fox, of course, is a long-term rights holder for Major League Soccer. And there is a desire, and that's part of Rod Stone's persona, is actually to promote MLS. But that seems to be the bottom line, whereas on ESPN FC, you will have these intense fights because there is an instinct from Alejandro Moreno, in particular, to defend Major League Soccer. But Taylor Twellman doesn't necessarily defend MLS, and you have the rest of the panel that is quite critical, even though they put as much of a lens and as much time into focusing on the U.S. national team.
At the end of the day, I think we all want to see the U.S. do well, and we all want to see them succeed, and we all want to see them go on to win the World Cup or any major tournament. But I don't feel that Fox is objective at all. I think that they are way in the tank, and so much so that they're not critical. So when the U.S. has had poor performances,
unless Klinsmann's the manager, and it's only about him then. Right? When Klinsmann was a manager, it was because of him, and
right.
He has to understand the American player, and he has to understand Major League Soccer and not disrespect it. And he's got to be more Americanized in his approach. Even though if you talk to someone in Germany, they think Klinsmann is very Americanized in the way he manages, but that's a whole other issue.
Yeah. So in the games against Martinique, in the games against, to a lesser extent, El Salvador, but and Panama, you look at these games and you go that the U.S. didn't play well, but the level of analysis post-match from Fox has been pretty much, it has not been critical at all in terms of the performance. And going back to what we've said in previous podcasts too, with Lallis's newest thing is kind of focusing on power rankings, where he's looking at the team and picking out the positive of the players, rather than focusing on, the 9 out of 11 players that had pitiful performances. So I get where Mike's coming from, and we all want to see the U.S. do well, but I would love to see NBC Sports cover the U.S. men's national team and see how they would do it differently.
Fox can solve this by making one move, which is putting Eric Winalda in the studio game.
If they give him time, though, because that's the thing, because there was a game.
But the fact that he's not even there, that speaks volumes to me.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Actually, the Panama-Martinique game was the one I listened to on Sirius Satellite, and I was listening to Fernanda Fiore. And Winalda was on that broadcast, too, and listening on the radio, I'm like, he's not getting any airtime. He's getting maybe 20 seconds here, 20 seconds there. He's not getting enough time to actually have a critical viewpoint and go into a little bit more detail about why he feels that way. But yeah, Kartik, you're right. I mean, why he's not there, that's ridiculous. And he's a guy, to me, that at least sees it as it is and will say it as it is. And most of the Fox folks are...
But again... I think that goes back to MLS, because when Alda has been very critical of the league and the way it develops players, I mentioned Richie Menjivar from El Salvador earlier in the show, who when Alda essentially discovered and turned into the player he is, that's now getting capped and playing regularly for El Salvador. I mean, he's an American race kid. And there are critiques Winalda makes of the U.S. soccer system and of Major League Soccer specifically, which I think don't jibe with the bombacity of Stone and Lallis and others who promote Major League Soccer. Now, I think it would be good to have that discussion on air, but they don't want to have that discussion on air. So he's not included. And therefore, you and I come to a conclusion that they're basically in the tank, because that's what you have to infer from Winalda's exclusion, or when he's on, the lack of time he's given to articulate his views.
One more thing on this one, Kartik, and that's that one of the Fox executive producers in the past, in an interview, talked about how that he likes to dumb down the soccer coverage for viewers in the U.S. because and a lot of it would be going to the mainstream audience, so kind of dumbing it down because soccer fans in the United States aren't as intellectual about the worldly about the sport from around the world, but to me that's again condescending. But to me, I mean, and that's why I said I'd love to see NBC Sports do some of these broadcasts, because Fox dumbs it down so much. I think that they always seem to be talking down to the audience, and in many ways too, kind of playing into that cheerleader's point of view. Where I'd love them to be a little bit more critical. It'll be a little bit more, because I think at the end of the day, most of the listeners and most of the people out there are watching the U.S. saying, okay, great, this is wonderful that they're winning these games. But we know that they're not playing that well. We know that there's really kind of...
But it extends beyond Fox, because I think that you're thinking that based on the people who watch Premier League games every week, Chris, and I get that. The people who are watching NBC every week are watching BN and watching La Liga, and they know what good football looks like. I think there are a lot of American fans, no offense, that don't. And a lot of American writers that play into that, and people on Fox who play into that. So, for example, again, Jurgen Klinsmann's the manager. This is terrible football. This is garbage. That would be Lallis's famous term that he would use often in the studio when the U.S. was playing under Klinsmann. And so there is the casual U.S. soccer fan who doesn't necessarily watch the Premier League or La Liga or the Bundesliga. They're not watching Fox for the Bundesliga, where the coverage has gotten better and better. Is making judgments based on that, and they think that somehow under Arena this is good football. I think that they don't necessarily know the difference, to be honest with you. I mean, that may sound condescending in my own way, but look, the way the Mexico game was covered, where the U.S. had 26% of the ball and didn't really make an attempt to play, they did have a clear tactical plan that worked to push Mexico into wide areas to crowd the middle of the field and to hit them on the break and use their athleticism and also play towards set pieces. There was the kind of analysis I saw after that match, which I think was driven by the coverage on Fox. And as I said on the podcast that week, I had changed the channel to Univision during the course of that broadcast. I think that spins a narrative for a lot of U.S. fans who just watch the national team and maybe watch Major League Soccer, but they don't watch the Premier League or La Liga, or they have a chip on their shoulder wanting to pound their chest and say, hey, our league is better than people give it credit for. How dare Gary Lineker say the things he did about our league, which I thought was a bit reactive. What Lineker said, but still, there's this defensiveness, and Fox plays into that because I think people left that Mexico game thinking it was some sort of great show, that it was some sort of great performance by the United States down at Azteca. When I was embarrassed that 20 years on from being able to do incredible things in Latin America, 20 plus years on from Copa America run in 1995 and World Cup 2002, that we played that way. A qualifier that we set up our team to play that way, which was an admission to me that we're not very good. Arena did a good job tactically, but to me it shows the United States doesn't have the personnel, doesn't have the quality in its depth. And that was not discussed on Fox, and that was not discussed in most of the articles written by U.S.-based soccer journalists after that match.
Yeah, a lot of the coverage is very short-term. I mean, my biggest criticism about the U.S. is that a lack of playing style. There is no playing style. It's very much haphazard, and it's not very technical. So, but this is, again, to Kartik, we mentioned this, I think, last week, that we should do a topic about
this
criticism.
We'll move on in a second. This is why you need to have Eric Winalda on the broadcast, because he will point that out. He will talk about style. He will talk about tempo. He will talk about player development. They have the guy at Fox. I mean, it's not like this is some sort of radical solution that, they have to go on and hire this one, that one. They have the guy there that can balance this out, and they're not using him. So that's my 2 cents on it.
And I think the reason why is because Lallis is there. So, I mean, that kind of takes the limelight or spotlight away from Lallis. I mean, if Lallis goes on vacation for a few months and goes to, wherever he wants to go, and they put Ronaldo in that, you would definitely see a different type of broadcast. And it's not that it would be negative or critical. It would just open the viewer's eyes to some of the things that he's seeing.
There's a whole generation of U.S. soccer fans, and I'll get off my soapbox after this, that have come to the game in the last few years who think Eric Winalda is some sort of anti-American clown or guy that's hypercritical or bitter or something, when he is... he was the premier U.S. attacking player for an entire generation, starting with the 1990 World Cup. And he is a guy who has seen the system inside and out, and his critiques are very valid. So at first there was a mocking of his critiques. Now I think that there's a real attempt to marginalize him even saying anything. Fox, his employer, is playing into that, in my opinion. Now, if they don't feel that's the case, I would love to hear their point of view on it.
it's definitely we can go on about this topic, but let's move on. All right, so Anthony Bello sent in an email. He says, I was wondering what your thoughts are about Jamie Horowitz being fired by FS1 and the impact on the network's soccer coverage. So Kartik, I'll answer this one really quickly, is that I don't think it's going to have that much of an impact on the soccer coverage. The parts of the Fox Sports puzzle that Jamie Horowitz was focusing more on was the manufactured debates with Colin Cowherd and all those other folks on TV. So having Horowitz out of there is not going to impact it for the soccer side. They weren't talking about soccer anyway. The second thing, which would probably have more of an impact, would be the foxsoccer.com website, which is a ghost of a site of what it used to be. It used to have some great coverage. Now it's just videos. And that's the one thing that may change with Horowitz being fired, is that maybe they'll start bringing back some good coverage and trying to pull people in that way. Other than that, I don't see any difference to the soccer coverage. For the most part, David Nathanson at Fox Sports is kind of ruling the soccer side, and then Eric Shanks as a higher up, kind of making some of the big decisions there. Next up is Clayton Davis, and he says he sent this in through email. He says, great idea for making only one team get out of the Gold Cup group stage. And this is going back to last week's show when we talked about some solutions of how to make the Gold Cup more watchable. Clayton says, I agree some urgency would be better. A shorter tournament or more time in between games would be good too. I think we agree there, Kartik. Next up is Raymond Orozco, and he sent this in through Facebook. He said, I would like to see Caribbean countries combined like they do in cricket and compete as the West Indies. So that's an interesting one from the Gold Coast.
That'll never happen.
It'll never happen. Because a lot of it is in terms of teams want... It's the same reason that Wales, Scotland usually do not want to have a Great Britain team, because then that makes each individual country... effectively meaningless. I mean,
also less powerful among CONCACAF. So now the Caribbean countries can control many of the proceedings, the members of CFU, if they're all individual separate countries, which is another reason why there's a desire to have Martinique and Guadeloupe and French Guiana and these French departments, these departments of metropolitan France, as CONCACAF members or CFU members, because it increases their voting share within CONCACAF. It's politics, unfortunately, but it will never happen. If you had a combined West Indies team, they would have been quite good. The number of guys that they've had playing in England for both Trinidad and Jamaica have been pretty remarkable the last 20 years. I'm sure they would have qualified for multiple World Cups without question in my mind if they had combined, but it won't happen.
And then the last question is from Karen from Facebook. And the question is, hi, what do you think of the takeover of Time Warner by AT&T and what this means for the future of UEFA Champions League broadcasts? So I'll answer this one. It won't change anything in terms of, Turner still has the rights to the Champions League, and Turner is owned by Time Warner, which is probably going to be owned by AT&T soon. But I do want to mention, and this comes from the website, from worldsoccertalk.com. Oliver Say has been writing quite a bit about it, so I'll quote him. And he says that the Time Warner AT&T merger will likely put some of the Champions League games on True TV and or HLN, which is formerly known as Headline News, which will give the companies the opportunity to hike the subscriber fee rates. So it could cost us more money via our cable or satellite bills in the future to get those channels. And, of course, the Time Warner and AT&T merger hasn't been approved yet, so everything could change. But it's still the rights still stay with Turner, and if anything, maybe there's going to be some cost-cutting measures, perhaps, by AT&T if they do acquire Time Warner. But in terms of broadcast, I don't think we'll see much of a difference based on if and when the merger happens. All right, Kartik, so if listeners do have any questions or feedback or comments, feel free to send those in to us through email at web@worldsoccertalk.com, through Twitter at WSoccerTalk, or through Facebook at facebook.com/worldsoccertalk. Now, Kartik, our feature topic of the week, and this one could be a big one, but the topic is America's love-hate relationship with soccer friendlies. And I'll have you kick it off, and then I'll chime in when if you get me enraged.
Yeah, I think that these games are largely meaningless. They're interesting for fans of specific clubs. I went to see Manchester City in 2010 in Atlanta. I went to see them in 2013 in New York. I haven't gone since. So they've been bad. They've come back every year, and I got my fill of it. At that point, I actually had my fill of it. In 2010, I was able to go in 2013 thanks to you and a promotion we were doing at World Soccer Talk. But I actually got my fill of it in 2010, back when Roberto Mancini was the manager and the club hadn't won any trophies in, at the time, 34 years. So to me, it's the American soccer audience is getting more sophisticated. The people who watch European football, and they realize that these are now meaningless friendlies. It may be interesting if you get a big signing like Manchester United has this year with Romelu Lukaku, or if you had when Pogba came last year, although they didn't come to the U.S. last year, did they? Were they in the U.S. last year? No.
No.
But when they make big signings, it's interesting to see those guys right away. But to me, I think the the market has now absorbed this as kind of a cash grab situation. You don't have the numbers flocking to the games or the buzz about, oh my gosh, Manchester United's coming to Pittsburgh type of thing that you used to have. It was something that we were talking about a few years ago. I mean, I remember having a conversation. We had an Atlanta Fort Lauderdale game in NASL when I was the communications director for the league that we had to move because there was a Chelsea AC Milan friendly taking place the same day, same night, same time, 15 miles down the road at Joe Robbie Stadium. So we moved the game to a Friday night. And at the time, Atlanta was coached by Eric Winalda. So it seems like Winalda keeps popping up on this podcast. But I remember talking to him about it and talking to our commissioner, David Downs, about it, about that game didn't sell out, that Milan-Chelsea game, and the previous friendlies that had been held in South Florida had sold out. Now, they got 62 or 65,000, something like that, but they didn't get the full 70. And that we were beginning to see maybe the American audience becoming more sophisticated, and AC Milan fans have seen their team once now. They're not going to drive for 300 miles to see their team again, et cetera, et cetera. That we're now beginning to realize the context around these friendlies, the context around these games, particularly in summers when they're major tournaments. Now, there was a Euro in 2012. 2017 is a little bit different because we're going into a World Cup year, right? Mm-hmm. But I think that's another thing is that you're talking about players that have to pace themselves because they're going to go straight through the real stars of the sport, like Cristiano Ronaldo, are going to have to go straight through from July to July if they play in these friendlies. Therefore, he's not playing in Real Madrid's friendlies here in the United States or ICC games or whatever you want to term them as. So I think we've grown sophisticated enough to realize these are friendlies. These games are largely meaningless. You can't make wide interpretations or wide judgments based on results. That having been said, you don't want to come over here if you're a European club and show really badly against US-based clubs. So that I think plays into a whole nother part of it where these games are competitive to the extent that I've seen European clubs come over and get beat by MLS teams, or struggle against MLS, USL, NASL teams. And you don't want to be one of those clubs. So I think there is a certain degree of fire and competitiveness you saw from Manchester United in the first half against the LA Galaxy, who are a much more known brand, right? Known commodity in Europe than Real Salt Lake.
But Kartik, though, I mean, I have to disagree with you here because I think in many ways, a lot of it's based on the US teams is how in terms of the LA Galaxy is one example of that match, is that it's not just about the European teams or teams from anywhere around the world coming and putting in a good performance, but it's also because it needs to be the US teams, whether it's MLS, NASL, USL teams, they also need to put in a good performance too. Because to me, watching that LA Galaxy against Man United match, that was one of the worst performances I've seen by a football team with LA Galaxy. That first half, I know that it was a second string. But the ease that Manchester United, they were just doing passing the ball around. There was no pressure from LA Galaxy in that first half. And even in the second half, when they brought out all the kind of the A-team players, where they brought out Jermaine Jones and Ashley Cole and all the other players, the first shot on goal in that entire match was not until the 80th minute. So for over 30 minutes, even with the A-team playing in the second half, they couldn't even get a shot on goal. And to me, that really, we'll get more into this in a bit, but to me, it's not just the teams from overseas playing well and making the games more meaningful, but also it relies on the U.S. teams too.
But it's about priorities because the Galaxy had a U.S. Open Cup match against San Jose that Tuesday. They get back to regular season MLS action. They're in a break. A few days later, they're in mid-season. How do you prioritize a friendly in training and in your squad selection? And again, this may be, there are rules, there are strange rules in MLS Was probably another reason we need Eric Winalda on Fox, but that's again. I guess maybe we can talk about that topic. But you don't have a squad, Chris. You don't have a squad.
I agree.
Where you can play three times in a week.
I agree.
And so if you have two competitive matches in a week, and you have a friendly, you're going to de-emphasize the friendly very naturally.
I agree. But if you're LA Galaxy, why are you even taking this match then, other than cashing in on the tickets?
Because
to me, then I mean, yeah, Real Salt Lake. Who put in a good performance against Man United. And to me, watching LA Galaxy, that was probably the first or second time I've seen them this season on television. So most of the MLS games I've seen, I haven't seen many LA Galaxy games because usually those are the later games and I've got kids and I usually watch the earlier games. But to me, as a neutral, as somebody who watches soccer for the love of watching soccer, I was looking at this performance by LA Galaxy and thinking, like, this is a joke. This is the first half was horrible. The second half wasn't that much better. And to me, it makes LA Galaxy look like a second-rate club against a Manchester United team that was just going through the motions, really, and playing really well.
You're right about Salt Lake. Salt Lake probably took it more seriously as an opportunity to get their name out there. So that you make a good point there, that even the contrast between the way Salt Lake approached the game and RSL had a game 48 hours later, a competitive game, versus the way the Galaxy did. That's actually a very good point.
But that's the thing, though, to me, is that if you are wanting to get these games to be more meaningful, is that both teams need to go into these matches with not going helter-skelter, because you don't want injuries on either side, but at least playing competitive soccer. And if you're not willing to play competitive soccer, then don't play. I mean, don't go on these tours, or don't host these friendlies against teams from around the world, because all you're doing is just cashing in. And you're making yourself look bad on television, national television, for the fans. I mean, maybe there were some United fans that went to that match. They've never been to a Galaxy match before, and they live in the Southern California area. In terms of them coming back, it's probably very unlikely. And it'd be interesting to see LAFC next year if they put in the same type of level of commitment against a foreign team, or whether they actually play up and try harder to be a little bit more competitive, to look better on television or to look better in person. But Kartik, I think personally speaking I get what you're saying in terms of these being meaningless friendlies, but I think they are meaningful. And the reason I think they're meaningful is because of the fans. Because it's one of those things that, yes, the foreign teams are looking at this way to increase revenue through, playing these lucrative friendlies, but also expanding the supporter base. But at the end of the day, these tickets are being bought. I mean, you're looking at any of these games that have been played this past week in the United States with foreign teams. Most of them have had great attendances. And it's interesting too, Kartik, because if you look at the US-Ghana game, which was in Nashville, which was the friendly before the Gold Cup, which was a great day. And it was after that game, there's a lot of people saying, like, hey, maybe Nashville could be a future MLS city. Well, the attendance for that was 28,000, which is great, a great number. But the expected attendance for the Man City against Spurs International Champions Cup friendly is going to be 60,000. So more than double the US national team. Even last night at Lincoln Financial Field in Philadelphia, the attendance was, I think, 31,000. Well, you're looking at last night, it was AS Roma against PSG in Detroit, and that had 60,000 people. So more than double. So that's the reason why I understand that these games are meaningless, because it doesn't really matter at the end of the day. But they are meaningful, and that's the part that gets me upset, because there's a lot of reporters and a lot of journalists out there that focus on MLS and that downgrade these types of games and say, for example, Jason Davis was on Sirius Satellite this week on his show, and he said that these games have no value. And to me, I completely disagree with that, because they have value, because there's people coming out to these games, watching these games. They're attached to these clubs. They want to see these players in person. And yes, the result is meaningless, but that there is value there. There's a lot of values there. And I think MLS reporters get very defensive about these games because they see the TV ratings, they see the attendances, they see the amount of traction that these games get. And meanwhile, MLS games get very little of that. And there's a lot of reporters that go out of the way not to cover ICC because they don't want to give it any more publicity than it's already getting.
Well, that's fair, but we have to distinguish between games between PSG versus Man City or whatever, right? Spurs versus PSG, and games that involve clubs from U.S.-based leagues, whether it be NASL or USL or also MLS. And I think for the NASL, USL, and MLS teams, these games are meaningless. Largely meaningless. They are impositions in the middle of a competitive season. I can tell you from having worked in NASL, these games cost you more money than you generate in revenue. Maybe you get your name out as a club or a serious club by having a friendly. So I think that's got to be a consideration. Now, as far as the fans flocking to these games and Nashville getting twice as many fans for Man City than they did for the U.S. men's national team. Yeah, but how many of those Man City fans that go to the game or Spurs fans that go to that game are persuadable, if you will, to watch Major League Soccer? I don't know if many of them are. So we're talking about a different audience here. Now, if you're a responsible soccer journalist and your agenda is to promote the sport and not just promote a specific league or specific ideology associated with that league, which is Major League Soccer, then, yeah, you should be covering these things equally. But we know we've already talked about Fox and talked about U.S. writers after the U.S.-Mexico game at Azteca. They're not that way. So, I wouldn't expect any different. And there is this. I think it's important for folks to understand who may not realize this. There is an ideology attached to supporting Major League Soccer and being a writer that covers Major League Soccer. It's almost like a cause for so many of the people who write about the league and cover the league and the Rob Stones who present the league. It's a cause. It's a cause that they want to promote, and they want to make MLS appear more relevant on the global stage and appear more to be of a higher quality than perhaps it is. And that's why we've also had this problem with the U.S. men's national team of every guy who's doing decently well in MLS being elevated as the next big thing for the U.S. men's national team. I think this is all part of the same debate. You know, we have these little tangential debates, oh, friendlies versus how the ICC is being covered versus a U.S. men's national team, et cetera. It's all part of the larger debate that we have two very distinct pots of soccer fans, or really three, if you include those who watch Liga MX and Latin American soccer and don't really watch European football. But for this purposes of this discussion, you have two separate and distinct pots of fans, people who watch European games, watch NBC, watch BN, and you've got a different pot of people who watch Major League Soccer, the U.S. men's national team, and watch Fox and watch ESPN. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost like a separate, and it's an opportunity actually for ESPN to reassert their relevance with the fans who watch BN and NBC. But I think they're separate fans, and the Jason Davises of the world, for all his attempts to appear to be interested in soccer as a whole, the Jason Davises of the world speak for that group that's watching Major League Soccer. That's all he speaks for. And I think he articulates their point of view and their ideology as well as anyone. He's really good at it. But that's a specific point of view. So that group, these games are meaningless.
Well, one of the reasons, too, because they get very defensive, is that because of the results. So if LA Galaxy loses 5-2 to Manchester United, then mostly on social media, but there's people saying, like, LA Galaxy is horrible, Manchester United's so much better. And you know, and this is why leagues outside of the U.S. are better than the leagues in the U.S. And to me, I kind of disregard all of that because it is not apples to apples by any means. But at the end of the day, it's still not a good look for MLS clubs that don't turn up for these games, that really are looking just to cash in. And from my point of view is that either you cash in and play or play competitively or you step out of this. Because there are some harmful aspects of U.S. friendlies or friendlies in the U.S. where it could look bad. On the vice versa, Kansas City Wiz, when they had that game against Manchester United and they won the game, was it like 4-3 or something like that, several years ago, that Sporting KC has said, executives have said, that was kind of the touch point. That was kind of the spark point for really taking Sporting KC and moving that to eventually become a fully fledged club and to be like a really exciting proposition, because that ignited the entire area, that people started talking about, hey, did you see that game? Because it was a very competitive game.
Right, arguably the best club in the U.S. Yeah, we did a ranking a couple years ago on World Soccer Talk, and I ranked them as, using a metric, not just totally subjective, but using a metric, I ranked them as the best club in the U.S., and they weren't, even by MLS standards at the time they played that game. That's a good point.
Yeah, but so these games, I mean, I think there is that love-hate relationship with it. I think a lot of people hate to see kind of people making theories based on
I think
the
there
results.
Was even a game in 2004 or 2005, I remember, between DC United and Chelsea, where Chelsea were at the height of their powers under Mourinho, and they came over to RFK and DC gave them a game. I think it ended up being 3-2, Chelsea won, or 2-1, something like that. But I remember that improving Major League Soccer standing as a whole in the European press, mm-hmm. and really kind of verifying the quality of MLS. Now, as it turns out, I think at the time in MLS, DC was probably the only team that could give a European club a game, honestly, and they just happened to play them.
There was that game too. I don't know if you remember this one, Kartik. It was DC United against Tottenham Hotspur at White Hart Lane.
And that's
the thing though too. I think these US friendlies in the US or anywhere around the world really can have a lot of meaning if teams are willing to actually be competitive, and it can spark interest.
Now, I have to point this out. Now, if we're going to look at this as some sort of metric and make judgments based on it, which I won't, but if you do, this might be why guys like Jason Davis get defensive. The results for MLS teams have gotten progressively worse in these games. I mean, we went from seeing the MLS never lose an all-star game, whether it was to Chelsea or Fulham or whoever they brought over, to then getting beaten 5-2, 7-0, these sorts of ridiculous score lines by Manchester United, the two-time, and then the Roma game. Roma just played MLS All-Stars off the park, really, really ripped them to pieces 1 year. I can't remember what year that was. And it just, these results have gotten, I think, progressively worse for MLS. Now, when the MLS All-Stars beat Bayern Munich, we never heard the end of it. So there is, I think these results have gotten progressively worse. That's part of it.
The other thing, though, cutting
which
to, you look at,
which is partly, I have to say, it's partly because the MLS talent level has been diluted by rapid expansion. But go ahead.
But you look at ICC, you look at last year 2016, and you look at this year 2017. There are no MLS clubs participating. And last year, when we interviewed Charlie Stilettano and asked him, like, hey, what's going on with MLS clubs? And he said, okay, well, it was a last-minute thing, and we weren't able to get any signings of any clubs to play in the 2016 tournaments. But we're definitely going to get some 2017 MLS clubs performing in that tournament. And at the end of the day, zero MLS clubs. So I think in many ways, I mean, I don't know if MLS clubs are specifically saying, okay, let's avoid ICC because it's really more of a, for lack of a better term, kind of a Euro snob competition, which I don't think it is, but still the quality level is very high and it's a different type of audience, perhaps. But, or if there are other reasons, you mean in terms of a crowded calendar, in terms of all these matches, not being able to fit them in?
Well, look, I'll even say this here in Florida. We have the Florida Cup, and we have not been able to get Orlando City to play in it. And we've had Fort Lauderdale playing it. We've had Tampa Bay playing it, NASL teams, Tampa Bay's now a USL team. We've had those sorts of teams. That's what the tournament's based upon.
Right.
We have not been able to get Orlando to play in it, and there are restrictions on the MLS calendar and the collective bargaining agreement. That's been part of it. I think also part of it has been there's just a genuine fear in MLS land of exposing yourself to these sorts of things unless you control the venue, you control the atmosphere, you control the date as far as money is concerned, and making money through SUM. So
I would say
I think that that's part of the reason they don't participate in the ICC.
Possibly. I would say that it seems that this summer there seems to be far fewer MLS clubs having friendlies against foreign opposition compared to previous years. So, yes, Man United played Real Salt Lake and they played LA Galaxy essentially as warm-up matches for ICC. You've had Eintracht Frankfurt play against Columbus, and they also had another game. But above and beyond that, there haven't been... I mean, the Swansea's been playing Philadelphia Union, but then the other clubs have been playing are USL clubs. But there are not a lot of friendlies, MLS clubs. So maybe it is a conscious decision where they're saying, okay, this is not really paying out for us. I think there are opportunities where it could pay off for them. But for whatever reason, they're not choosing to take those. And maybe they just see that it's a lose-lose for them. And maybe at the end of the day, it is for many of them. But I don't know. To me personally, just to kind of finish on this note, Kartik, unless you have anything additional to add. But for me, I do find the friendlies meaningful. I think I agree that the results are meaningless, but meaningful in terms of just the amount of people that show up for these games, the passion from the supporters in the stadiums, the great opportunities that fans get to see their favorite clubs in person. And I think judging by the ticket sales and judging by the amount of interest, I think this is a win-win for those clubs overseas. And I think that these friendlies are a good thing for soccer in the United States because it does help the sport grow.
Yeah, I would agree. It definitely helps the sport grow. It's on the surface, the games actually taking place is a good thing for soccer in this country. I do think, though, however, there are some serious questions as to the importance of the games in terms of football, soccer, and also whether or not the fans that watch European matches are actually persuadable to MLS in its current form, or whether even that it goes the other way too, right? Yeah. Whether the quality of watching Juventus play a Real Madrid, I mean, it's that you don't get higher quality than that in the world of football. And I don't care if it's a World Cup final. I don't care if it's Germany versus Spain. A Germany versus Spain game is not as high quality as a Bayern Munich versus Real Madrid game. It just isn't, honestly. And although that they would push it, that pushes it, obviously, because so many of the same players. But in Italy versus a Spain game is not as high quality, although it's interesting. It's a great game as a Juventus versus Real Madrid game. This is as high quality as you get. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is kind of a resentment among those who are ideologically tied to promotion of Major League Soccer and U.S. soccer as a cause. Now, I have to say, and I'll just wrap up on this, there are good reasons why people get defensive about their support of MLS and U.S. soccer, because there are Euro snobs in this country. I'm sorry, I hate to use the term. There are people who are really condescending, that live in this country, work in this country, watch American sports, take their kids to soccer practice in the morning, but are condescending about any professional soccer played in this country. And we have to deal with that. Those of us who've worked in this country and have worked in the game in this country, as I have for almost a decade, and have try and support soccer in all its different forms. But sometimes it manifests itself into this ugly shouting match and things like Davis saying, "Hey, these games are meaningless. I don't care."
Type of thing. I think it's, in many ways, though, too, Carter, that's a good point, because you look at the Gary Lineker comments that he put on Twitter when he was watching the LA Galaxy against Man United game, saying that MLS is so far off some of the top teams or top leagues in the world. But that's the thing, though, too. I mean, the contrast between those two games, the LA Galaxy game against Man United and the Real Salt Lake game against Man United, that Real Salt Lake team, I was really impressed. And if I'm somebody that lived in the Salt Lake City region and I had never been to an MLS game before, I would probably go back to watch Real Salt Lake based on that performance in the first 30 minutes. Vice versa with LA Galaxy, I'd probably say, okay, I'm never spending any of my money with this club because the performance level that they put into this was pathetic. So,
well, that might explain why Salt Lake, their local television ratings, they get like a 5 or 6 share locally, and the Galaxy get less than a 1 share. Because I think it's about approach. People say the Galaxy are a big team, but they don't have there are like a handful of people watching Galaxy games when they're on the road on television in that market who don't go to the games already. Where Salt Lake, there's a whole bunch of fans who don't get to go to the games that won't watch that team, and that manifests itself. So it manifests itself in television ratings and getting support locally when your team goes away from home as well. And I've drawn the contrast, actually, ironically enough, talking about television ratings between those two clubs and their local ratings on their channels when they're on the road, when they're away from home. And it's funny that we've had the same contrast between those two clubs in how they've approached this. That might be part of it. There might be people who've never gone to a Real Salt Lake game or don't go often who say, okay, I saw them now against Manchester United. They played well. I'm going to turn on their next away game in Major League Soccer. Whereas if you're a casual LA person who, of course, would expect an even higher quality product than you probably do in Salt Lake City, in Utah, and you watch that, why are you going to watch a Galaxy game after that?
Yeah, precisely. And I think at the end of the day, it's one of those things where I think for teams in the US, whether you're USL, NESL, NPSL, or MLS, is that it's not a given that you just open a club and then all of a sudden people start coming to your games. I think it's one of those things you have to earn respect. And by if you do decide to play in these friendlies against foreign opposition, that to me, you need to be competitive because it is an opportunity to bring in fans for the long term, not just a short-term cash grab.
And you also showcase your stadiums. I mean, I think StubHub Center isn't one of my favorite facilities, but the Salt RSL Stadium, Rio Tinto in Sandy, is one of the better stadiums in this country. So you get the chance to show off your stadium against Manchester United. People aren't going to flock to your stadium when you play. I think you're convincing me as we go on in this argument, in this discussion. But when you play the Colorado Rapids or you play Sporting Kansas City or Minnesota United, but you have the chance to show off that stadium, which is why I was surprised Orlando didn't do any friendlies at home this year with their new stadium. They've been willing to bring Stoke in and Newcastle in and Brazilian clubs, Ponte Preta, Sao Paulo in the past, when they played at the Citrus Bowl, but unwilling to in their new stadium. I mean, I think it would be a great opportunity to show off their new stadium.
That's why I think it's that there has been a conscious effort to limit these games. It just seems that to be far fewer friendlies than what we've been used to in the past before, where we've had even championship clubs, a lot of championship clubs coming and playing. And we haven't seen that this summer. So I think it's a conscious effort on MLS clubs' point of view in terms of or US clubs to that they don't see the value in this. And I do see the value, but you have to earn it. And there's a lot of work that goes into it.
I have to say on that, and maybe we can wrap up on this. It is expensive and cost prohibitive if you're a US club to bring in, no offense, but to bring in Swansea, to bring in Cardiff, to bring in Sheffield Wednesday, to bring in Fulham or Watford. These lower-end Premier League teams are high-end championship teams. It's tough. Those teams don't necessarily have the fan base to justify opening a game and trying to sell a 20,000-seat stadium on it. Now, if you're talking about Spurs and Everton and Man United, Man City, Arsenal, and then obviously the big Spanish clubs, it's a completely different ball of wax. The difference between getting Watford for a front friendly and Everton for a friendly is massive. So it's not just getting a Premier League club, but it's getting one that's going to drive an audience. Unfortunately, Everton, it costs a lot more to bring Everton than it does to bring Watford or Swansea. Right. So it all goes back to economics. But it is cost effective to bring in Everton, even if you have to pay $500,000, because you'll sell the stadium out and you'll get recognition if you take the game seriously.
For USL and NASL clubs, I think it's probably too much to ask in terms of trying to do these friendlies in terms of the costs involved. For MLS, I disagree with you, Kartik, in terms of I think there is an opportunity there. Just as one example of one game, and that was Swansea against Philadelphia Union. A lot of the Philly Union fans were expecting about 5,000 fans. The attendance for that game was over 16,000. So, and that was on the same night that the US played in the Gold Cup. So I think there is an opportunity if you promote it correctly. And don't oversaturate the market to bring in some even lower, I mean, Swansea almost got into the championship, but some lower Premier League clubs and bring them in, give them the training facilities, but then use that as an opportunity to introduce new soccer fans to your MLS club, perhaps. But all right, Kartik. So thanks for listening. You can get a new episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast every Thursday. Every episode is released on SoundCloud, YouTube, Stitcher, iTunes, Audio Boom, and worldsoccertalk.com. If you like the show, share it with your friends on social media, and please give us a review on iTunes. We greatly appreciate it. And Kartik, what should they do?
Enjoy your football.